Good afternoon, and welcome to another in an ongoing series of Afternoons With, sponsored by the Los Angeles section of the Audio Engineering Society. And this afternoon's guest is Jack Mullen, who has a long history of involvement with audio. He was educated as an electrical engineer and graduated as that in 1936, and his senior thesis, interestingly enough, was the development of a stereo disc cutter using the vertical modulation for the left channel and horizontal lateral modulation for the right channel. On duty with the Signal Corps in World War II, he happened upon the German magnetophone tape recorder and became involved with that. After analyzing it, managed to get some samples sent back, the spoils of war, I guess, to the United States. They were further analyzed and experimented upon, and whereupon Ampex was created, and the original magnetophones were replaced by an early form of Ampex tape recorder. The rest of that is fairly well into the general legend and lore of audio by now. In the late 40s, early 50s, Mr. Mullen established a lab for research into videotape, and by 1951, the first pictures were shown after being recorded on videotape. That lab was eventually sold to 3M, and it was with 3M that Jack Mullen continued his work until he retired a few years ago, where he was primarily responsible for development of instrumentation and audio recorders, has a flock of patents to his name. The best known is probably the isolation loop drive, so-called isoloop drive. Anyway, I'd like to introduce Jack Mullen. And I'd like to begin by asking you to fill in the details of what to me is a fascinating story about which I don't know enough, that how exactly you came upon these German tape recorders and how you managed to get them to the United States.
I was still active in the Signal Corps, and the Signal Corps got over a an FM communication set, which was the ANTRC-1, which was supposed to be real hot stuff. Well, we found that the receivers were interfered with very greatly by radar frequencies that the British were using. And so the problem was to knock down this terrible blast from the pulses, if possible. So I was working on that project and working late at night, and we used to listen to the radio and BBC, and I always liked classical music, so the second program on the BBC was my favorite program. And that went off earlier than the others, actually, of course, because it was limited interest. And so then you fish around, and we generally landed on Germany because they were putting out good, strong signal and no interference and nice music, and the music would go on all night long, and it would sound like big orchestras playing, and there apparently were no breaks in it. You didn't hear any side changes. If they were playing 78 RPM records, there was no record scratch. And in those days, they weren't using 33 and a third anyway, to my knowledge. The British weren't. The BBC was not using 33 and a third. They had to get into it, though, during the war, because they were getting programs from the States. They were getting the Jack Benny Show and all these popular shows here, and they were making a big hit in Britain, not just with the GIs, but with the British people. And so they were. It was a source of program material for the BBC, and so they had gotten into 33 and a third in order to play those. I don't think they were cutting any of them. When they cut records, they were still doing 78s and lacquer. But these programs from Germany sounded so much better, and you wondered if they weren't just using live orchestras, and Hitler said, okay, you will play all night, you know. So that was what it was. But we found out later, of course, what it was. After the invasion, our organization, I was no longer with the RAF then, but back in London at our headquarters, and our whole organization transferred over to Paris. And we had a couple of guys in our group that were really go-getters and ferrets. If you wanted anything, these guys were able to get it. And so the CO of our group said, we need a place for headquarters, place to hang our hats. And one of these guys found a Maharaja of India's palace in Paris on the corner of a park This building is a stone building, 3 feet high, 3 stories high, a big basement in it, and he found that this he could get for us, and this was our headquarters.
Poor fellow.
Yeah.
That's a requisition sergeant.
Well, our group, it really was. We had a rough time, I'll tell you. Had to walk about 3 blocks to get to the mess 3 times a day. Which was pretty awful.
How was the food?
The mess was the Hotel Majestique, which is the hotel, you know, that the Vietnam thing was held in.
Oh,
yeah. The negotiations went on for so long. Well, that was the hotel that was our mess.
Hmm.
How was the food?
Yes.
It was very good. It was GI, but it was good. I mean, we always lived. Everything I've ever had in my life has been a good deal. I am the most fortunate person I know. I really have got to say that.
Wonderful thing to be able to say that,
yeah.
I realize.
And it's still today.
It's partly in the eye of the beholder, I'm sure.
I should knock wood someplace, but I guess that's good. Anyhow, this building had a lot of big rooms in it, and of course it was cold, and there was an air raid shelter down in the bottom that had been built out of big timbers, big heavy timbers. So the first thing the guys did was knock down the air raid shelter and start burning it in the fireplace to keep warm. That got us through the winter comfortably. But it had some nice big rooms, and our function, incidentally, became, among other things, to follow. As soon as forces pushed the Germans back any place and drove them out of some city, to get in there and to scrounge around and see what developments the Germans had brought into there, signal-wise. Our interest was signals, telephone, radio, radar, so forth. And so find out what the Germans had been doing and if they'd been running any development labs or had people working for them and, you know, talk to people and see what they left behind and so on. So we had several teams, and these guys would go out in the fields and find stuff. And our place was so big that they'd bring all this stuff back, and we had these rooms that were just loaded with apparatus and so on for study. And our function was to study this stuff and to write reports on it and send the samples of it back to the Signal Corps in New Jersey, Fort Monmouth. And that's what I was in, right in the middle of that operation. And one day we got word that there was something funny. We'd heard rumors of this, and the thing is still mysterious as far as I'm concerned, but we'd heard that the American Air Force had reported that as they flew over a certain area north of Frankfurt that their engines stumbled and stuttered and almost quit but didn't quite, and they'd make it past this point. So there was this rumor about the Germans having something to stop airplane engines by radio or radar. And it happened that there was a big tower on the top of a hill near this place. And so another guy and I got a car and a driver, and we went out there to look at this thing from Paris to Frankfurt. And it was very strange because this was a big, high, big, tall wooden tower. And incidentally, on the latest maps I see of Germany, it still says Turm, T-U-R-M, on that spot, like there's still a tower there. I've never been back there since. But this was a big wooden tower, all enclosed. It wasn't like a derrick for oil, an open derrick. It was all enclosed. And floor after floor, it must have been about 8 floors high. And we went in and we went all through this thing. There wasn't much to find. There was a telescope in one place that was still there, but everything had been torn out except down in the basement, underground actually, big concrete vault underground, there were 2 enormous diesel engines with generators on them. Tremendous. The generators were as high as this ceiling. And that was all that was left. I mean, everything else had been taken away.
Something in there.
So they'd certainly been doing something there, yeah. And I got talking to a man in the British Army there, casually. They were looking at the thing, too. And we got found out we were interested in sound recording and stuff like that. And he told me that, he asked me if I had heard this machine that they had down at Radio Frankfurt. And I said, well, what is it? We had already, incidentally, I'm getting ahead of the story, we had had several teams bring back to the place in Paris these tape recorders that the Germans had developed that were called a Tonschreiber, or sound writer. And they were really made by the magnetophone people, and they were a simplified version of the thing that I found later. They were a crude machine. in some ways, but very sophisticated in others. They had variable speed drive, for example. It was a phonic wheel motor, synchronous motor, with a variable speed, a variable frequency oscillator, so that you could run the thing from about 1 inch per second up to about 30. It was a tremendous speed range that you could get on them, and they were small and portable.
And what was the year? What period were we talking about? 46?
No, this is 45, 1945.
So this was, what was the, where in, I mean, VE Day was May of 45, I believe. So what was, yeah. I mean, but you were able to get into Germany?
Oh, yes, this was, the war was still on when we were doing all this. In 44, we
you
got over,
how did you, following the lead
right after the invasion, we went to Paris in June of 44.
Okay. So following the leading edge of the
yes,
but Frankfurt, right. Frankfurt was already liberated
right.
at that point. I see. Okay, mm-hmm.
And this man had been down to the Radio Frankfurt operation, which now had been, because of the bombings, had been evacuated from Frankfurt to a little town northeast called Bad Nauheim, and it had been taken over by Armed Forces Radio Service, who was operating the whole thing in a house. They had moved equipment, the Germans had moved equipment out of Frankfurt to this house, and it was the headquarters for the operation when it was still German broadcast for that area. And then when the armies were driven out, the Americans took this over and were operating it. And he said he had seen this machine down there that used this tape and it sounded great. Well, I discounted what he said because we had made tests on these tone shrivers and it sounded like the same kind of machine, and we'd found they had 35 dB signal to noise, which was no good for anything for quality-wise. A shellac phonograph record had better signal to noise than that. And so I didn't think much of it, but I kind of mulled it over in my mind, and as we left this tower on the top of the hill and came down the mountain, got to the bottom, if I had turned right, I was on my way back to Paris. If I turned left, I would be heading for Bad Nauheim. And of course, I had every intention of just going back home, because it was late in the afternoon, and we wouldn't get to Paris until late at night. But something suggested that I go and see what this guy was talking about, because he swore the fact that this thing sounded very good, and I thought he must have had a tin ear. So we went, and I guess about 5 in the afternoon we arrived at this place, and I asked the signal corps officer in charge if I could hear this machine that they had that used tape. And he said, oh, yeah, sure, okay. So he spoke to a German, and the guy went out in the back room and got a roll of tape and brought it in, put it on the machine, turned it on, and that's when I flipped. Never, ever had I heard anything like that. And I'd heard film and discs and, you know, everything there was before, as far as I know. I had heard Phillips Miller. That's another system that you may be familiar with that was supposed to be the world's best up to this time. I'd heard that on the BBC. They were using it. That's the only time I ever heard it. So I heard it over the radio.
Did they have bias on that tape?
That's right. That was the thing. What they had was a highly refined mechanism compared to the military tone shriver, and they had this tape, which I hadn't seen before. It was a little different from the tape that we'd seen on the tone shriver. The tone shriver tape was acetate with a coating on it, very much like what we have today. The tape that they were using on this machine was impregnated. It was a plastic known as Luvatherm that they made only in Germany. They've never made it in this country. And 3M always said that it starts with a different base. I'm not a chemist, so I don't know. They say they start with a coal base rather than an oil base, and this makes a difference in what they come up with in the plastics. It could be made here, but they never wanted to get into it. But it's not the plastic only, which is a very lovely plastic. It's limp and very strong lengthwise, but not much strength this way. It has long molecules tied together. So you can take it lengthwise and do this and make two out of it. Just to go on for maybe 10 feet before it runs off one side. Anyhow, that plastic was mixed when they make it with the oxide. And the oxide, therefore, is diluted by the plastic. And the level you get out is definitely down from the other, but it worked a lot better for our purposes.
Was the comb Schreiber tape the high coercivity of black stuff?
No. There was a black oxide. That's true, but that was very noisy, we found. But there was a brown oxide that was very much like the brown oxide that was used in this Lubritherm. So the same oxide, I think. And that plus the high-frequency bias, that's what made the system. You now had uniform motion. You had a very low background noise and full frequency range because they ran at 30 inches a second, and they were equalized out to 12 kc at the time. That's as far as they were going. And so I said, well, this is got to find out about this. So we got the instruction manual, and a guy that was with me had a camera, and we took pictures of the circuits right there and the information in German. And then when we got back to Paris, I converted one of the machines we had there to run this way, and it performed very well. Then we got some of the machines in that had the same mechanism as the kind they were using in the broadcast service, which was the better mechanism, and that converted to high-frequency bias with some of this tape. Oh, I managed to get two or three rolls of tape from this guy right there that day in Frankfurt, and that did it. We used to turn the thing on and play a phonograph record into it, you know, and you play it back, no noise first, no sound, then you hear the record scratch, then the full fidelity of the record and so forth. It was amazing. You'd A-B it and it would sound just like we do now, you know. Having gotten the information and converted one of these machines, we then wrote reports on this to the Signal Corps and sent them off, and that was the last we ever heard of that. We had done our duty on that score. The interesting thing, as far as I was concerned then, was that we now had four or five of these machines laying around this in the Maharaja's palace, which were absolutely useless to anybody. They were 35 dB signal-to-noise DC bias. They were these good mechanisms, but they had the old DC bias on them. The only ones that ever had high-frequency bias were the ones they put in the broadcasters.
Were these used primarily as dictating machines, or
yes.
What was their...
Yeah, yeah, and telephone monitoring, things right. of that sort, by the, you know, the SS or whoever had use for such things. The machines I have were actually a set of a pair that had alternate shuttling back and forth for continuous monitoring of telephone conversations. One would run and the other would rewind and wait, and when this one was about to run out, the other would start, and so on. And it has a dial on it. It's the only pair that I've ever seen like this. It has a dial that you can set so it'll only go back so far. If you want to keep something that you've gotten, then it'll only shuttle back to that and take it from there on out, until you get something else, you see. And then the operator would set the dial for that one. And eventually you'll run out of tape and have to change the tapes. But until that time comes, it'll just keep using the same two tapes. That's the way it was, but only DC bias. And for speech.
Now that was the low-quality machine.
Yeah. Well, yes, it was the good mechanism that they used in the broadcast service, but low fidelity.
How large a contrivance was this, physically?
They're about this wide.
So it's about 15
about
inches
that high.
By 10 inches
about
high,
so
by
deep,
15
yeah.
inches deep.
But they're heavy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Got three big ones.
Magnet bias or coil?
That was a coil. Coil on the eraser and a coil on the, it's the record head with DC in it. And
what size reels did these use?
They're, the spools of tape are about, and incidentally they're pancakes. They never used reels on those machines. Huh. They just used pancakes. They're about 10 inches.
How wide was the tape?
Quarter inch. Just like we
use 6 millimeter probably or something.
Yeah,
that's always stuck.
There's a very strange thing about that. When Ampex took one of my machines and started making measurements on it, they found everything scaled off in the English system.
You said 30 inches. I was wondering. Did they?
It's 77 centimeters actually.
Okay.
Why 77 centimeters? You know, it's a strange number. Okay, I managed to get a hold of a couple of these machines, and in order to get them home. I, of course, had no electronics. I didn't care about that. I knew what the circuitry was. We'd modified the machines and made circuits up out of American tubes right there in Paris and so on. So all I wanted was the machines and some tape.
Just the transport.
Right. And so I managed to get this pair of two machines, and...
Well, how did you manage to get
them? Well, they were laying around in the lab. I mean, our teams had sent these things into the lab there in Paris. And but we did our job in reporting on them and sending some samples.
We can stop.
No, nobody was that interested. I was the only one. One other guy, Jim Menard.
They were surplus then, huh?
Yeah, right. Jim Menard was interested. He and I worked together on these things. And sure, they were just surplus laying around, so I got two of them. And in order to get them home, they had to fit in a mail bag and only weigh so much as a souvenir of war. My biggest problem was getting the cases, because I couldn't take the cases apart, but I took everything else apart. I took the whole machines apart, and I made little wooden boxes for them. I had 18 boxes of stuff that I sent home to San Francisco through the mail. I didn't care what it cost, and of course it didn't cost that much in those days anyway, but I guess it cost me about $100 to send the stuff home. But the main thing, as I say, was the case. You can't take this leatherette case apart, so again, one of our crafty guys, one of these same guys that had procured the Maharaja's palace for us, had somehow gotten hold of a mail bag that was a little oversized. And this was our mail bag, and we used it. It was a funny, darn, you know, it said U.S. mail on it and everything. So what we would do was take this mail bag down with stuff in it and take it to the postal guys, GIs, and say, okay, we want to mail this stuff. We pull it all out of the bag and give it to him. See, he saw it come out of a bag, and he'd take it. And that was it.
I see.
How it got home, I don't know what it did.
As long as it fitted in a mail bag, that
yeah.
was all you needed to
fit
have.
In our bag.
Your bag, right. That's great.
And we'd take our bag back and use it the next time. So that's how they got home. And of course I was most concerned about whether they arrived home or not. And there was only one thing I wanted to do. I walk in the door when I got home, say hello to my mother, and go downstairs and see what if everything was there. So I counted the packages, and sure enough, they were all there.
Great.
So immediately I wanted to go to work on that, because I felt I had the only one in captivity, the only pair of machines. Excuse me.
Was one male and the other female? Or,
it would have been convenient for reproduction purposes.
Oh, no. Peter, you walked into it.
Yeah. Unfortunately,
set it up for him, that's all.
I was never quite able to determine. Anyway, tape. I needed tape, of course, for these things, so that before I left Paris, I had to take a number of these trips into Germany, like the one where I had uncovered this thing. And every time I did, I looked up the local radio station in whatever city we went to, and it was always run by the GIs, by the AFRS, and I'd pull my rank on them, because this time I was a major, and I'd say, I need some of that tape. Can you give me a few rolls of it? And I said, oh, sure. You know, hand me a dozen rolls or so. So I got 50 rolls this way. And I sent those home as nice little packages, too. So that was my supply of tape, 50 of these rolls.
This was all the Luvatherm tape?
Yeah, all Luvatherm, impregnated Luvatherm. That was called a Type L tape. Then they came out with an LG layer, which was Luvatherm plastic, but coated with the oxide. I never had any of that. I didn't need it. It was all right.
Early BASF tape was Luvatherm, I think.
Yeah, well, this was made by what is now BASF. It was IG Farben. The little symbol IG all over everything. IG, that's all they had. So it was made by Farben, which is the same outfit. Okay, so anyway, I guess that's about the story of getting it home. So I set these up, and I was only one thing.
Did you have an objective except interest at that time? Did you have any goal in bringing them home except just being interested in having them?
Well, I thought that they were so outstanding that they were going to be something sensational, but I didn't think that I would ever be in a position at that time that I wound up in, an admirable position. I thought that, well, we've done this for the Signal Corps. The Signal Corps will disseminate the information to any interested party in the Department of Commerce. anyone could get any information on any German development through the Department of Commerce. And of course, immediately we knew RCA and Western and Bell Labs would be getting all this information. They had been the manufacturers, Western Electric and RCA, manufacturers of all the broadcast equipment, all the recording equipment of any, you know, professional stature. I'm not talking about Presto and so on. I'm talking about broadcast stuff and film and so on. And so I thought, well, there isn't a chance of it ever amounting to anything commercially as far as I'm concerned, but these are just great to have, and they're just, I'm so happy just to have them because they're so outstanding. So I got them set up and built the electronics for them, and the word got around in San Francisco, and I worked with Bill Palmer up there of Palmer Films. He and I had been friends for years, and we immediately put them to work at his studio, and we were doing original recording for film. I guess we were the first people in the States to do this, doing soundtracks on the magnetophones and then transferring the good takes to film for the soundtrack rather than doing everything on film and throwing away a lot of film. As soon as we got them working and people would come in the studio and be very impressed and so on, I knew a man who was at the Institute of Radio Engineering there. He was chairman of the IRE, and he had actually been over in Signal Car too, but he hadn't any news of this, so I got in touch with him and told him about it, and he saw a demonstration, and right away he wanted us for the program for the IRE. So the 16th of May, 1946, was the most memorable night. That's the night that we prepared a tape, and I've got some of that on here at KFRC and at NBC, little excerpts of programs and stuff like that. And that was the night when it hit, and interestingly enough, Harold Lindsay was at the meeting. Harold Lindsay was one of the people left over in Ampex after everything had stopped at the end of the war, and there were only about six or seven people in the whole company, and Harold was one of them.
Now, what kind of motors were they building during the war? I read that
they were aircraft motors.
Actuator?
Yes, I think so. They were doing it for Dalmo Victor, and these were motors for radars.
But that was their whole business, just building motors.
Yeah, right. And in the back of this little factory, there was a big pile of these motors back against the back wall. I can remember seeing them that had never been delivered, you know, made, but no more need for them. And so they were wondering what they were going to do. But Harold wasn't the only one interested in high-quality sound. There were three or four others there, and they'd gotten their heads together and were wondering, what shall we do? And we'd like to do something in sound. And Harold was always hot on loudspeakers. He wanted to design a new loudspeaker, which is what he's done in the last few years, incidentally. But some of the others wanted to make a disc recording lathe or a high-quality turntable for playing records. And they hadn't decided on any of these things as yet. And Harold heard this that night at the IRE. And the fall meeting of the Society of Motion Picture Engineers, SMPE, no SMPTE at that time, okay. SMPE, T wasn't in it yet, and didn't amount to much yet. They had, of course, a convention down here in Hollywood every year, and Bill was very active in the SMPE, and so we drove down, he and I came down to the convention, and just before we left, he said, why don't we throw a magnetophone in the back of the car? Maybe somebody would like to see it, but we weren't on any program or anything. I said, sure, fine. So we did that, and we got down here, and Marvin Kamras gave a paper on film, magnetic film. It was the first paper that I had ever heard of on this subject, and he demonstrated it. He had a sound dummy that he brought out from Chicago with him. You know, a big machine stood on the floor. And he had prepared about 100 feet of 35 millimeter film with black oxide on it that he had put on with a paintbrush. And it sounded very good. I mean, he had recorded some music on it. Everyone's eyes were opened by this. It was the first time that the SMPE had a demonstration of magnetic playback on film, as far as I know. And so we got talking, and of course the word finally got out that we had this thing in the car. I didn't do it. I think Bill dropped it or somebody asked or something. So nothing would happen but to set it up at somebody's room in the old Hollywood Hotel. And people were coming in and listening to it and so forth. And Mr. Poniatoff was down for the convention, and Harold had told him that we were going to be down here, and he looked us up and he wanted to talk about it. He'd heard about it, but we hadn't met Poniatoff before. And so we said, well, you want to hear it? Fine. So he took a listen, and that was when he went back up there and decided he thought that's what the company should get into.
Was the company called Ampex while they were building these motors during
yes.
the war?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So Ampex preceded
but it,
the...
But they really were a subservient, or whatever you want to put it, to Dalmo Victor. They were not their own boss. They had a tie-in with Dalmo Victor, and a man by the name of Mosley up there that ran Dalmo Victor, when he got wind of what was going on here, he made it very difficult for the relationship to be established between Ampex and Bing Crosby, because he wanted in on it. And they finally managed to get that thing worked around where he was pretty well excluded from it, right, fortunately. I'm not knocking him, it's just business, that's all. And we had at this point a little stickler in the whole ointment as far as the ability to work with Ampex was concerned. That was that a man by the name of Colonel Ranger, whom you may have heard of, was in the Signal Corps. When I was in the Signal Corps, I was in Europe and he was at Fort Monmouth, and he used to come over on special assignments looking into things. One of the things he looked into was photographic color, AGFA's color system, for example. He got all the information on that, took it back for the Department of Commerce and the Signal Corps. He was interested in all kinds of developments, such as, but he'd come to our headquarters because we were the outfit that was looking into these things. And so he, I had met him on about three of these trips. He'd come, we'd gotten fairly well acquainted. However, I did not see him after I found out about this magnetophone. He had not come back, and I had come on my way home. I was on my way home. It was Thanksgiving of 1945. When I was returning home from Europe. And I went first to the Signal Corps in Fort Monmouth. And it was a day or two before Thanksgiving, and I was there in this barracks building, and I was in bed, and the light came on, and there was an empty bed there, and who walks in but Colonel Ranger. Now, Colonel Ranger lived in Newark, so he wasn't very far from home, but he'd come down to Fort Monmouth for work the next day, and so he was going to stay the night. And we got talking, and he invited me to his home for Thanksgiving dinner, which was very nice. So Thanksgiving Day came, I went to his house. Now, I had sent everything home, as I have told you, 18 packages to San Francisco, except for one thing. That was the heads. I figured there might be something in these heads. If I lost everything else, it was only mechanical stuff. You could make a machine, but what's with these heads deal? I mean, we didn't know enough about them to know that there must be maybe something very magical about them to perform the way they did. So I hand-carried the heads, and I had them with me in Fort Monmouth, and he had been making electric organs before the war, different kinds of electronic organs, not the kind we have now, but whirling, rotating wheel types like the Hammond organ and so on. And younger people won't remember this, but you may have heard them in some recreations of old broadcasts, but NBC used to have what they call the Ranger Tone Chime at the end of every program. Well, when NBC first started, they had dinner chimes, those things, the tubular chimes that go boom, boom, bing, 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 you know, about four notes. And in the studios, the announcer used to stand by the microphone. The announcer's mic was always by the wall, near the wall in the studio, and he had a control console there, actually, where he could punch up the mics that would be active in the studio, and he could put the studio on the air and take it off at the end of the program. The mixer was in a behind a glass window, but the announcer had a lot of control in those days, and he had this chime thing beside him on this console, and at the end of the program he'd say, this is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company, and he'd go bong, 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 three notes. Well, that was a little difficult to control, this volume and everything, so Ranger developed this Ranger tone chime, which was installed on racks at all headquarters as the system changed to control in the control room completely rather than studio. And it was a unit 19 inches wide and about this high, and it was like a music box. It had three little rolls in it with pins, just like you have in a music box with a comb of teeth, and then a magnetic pickup, so that it would make one revolution when they pushed the button and go bong, bong, bong. And it was a very musical, very rich chime sound. That was his big thing, Ranger tone chime. So,
great inventions of Western yeah, man.
Right. Right. So anyway, here was Ranger, my knowing of his interest in those things, I thought, well, he might be interested in this magnetic recording stuff. So I took these heads to his house the next day, Thanksgiving Day, and he had never seen or heard of them. It was a complete new thing to him. Either that or he was playing awful dumb.
Did he outrank you?
Yeah, he was a colonel, and I was a major at the time. But He showed interest in it, but it was apparently the first he'd ever heard of it. The next thing I knew, of course, I was back in San Francisco. The next thing I heard was Ranger was back over in Europe, and he was scrounging around all over Germany, getting all the information on this thing, and getting machines sent back, and then latest models being sent back to the Signal Corps, and he was working at the Signal Corps, studying them when he got back to New Jersey and so on. So he decided to go into this business after he got out of the Army.
Were these original machines Telefunken?
AEG.
AEG.
But they said they may have a Telefunken label on them too. It just depends, you know. They were tied in together. Then he decided to make these machines, and we were in touch then. He kept in touch with me all this time after I had introduced him to the thing, and he let me know everything he was doing. It was very interesting to see what he was finding out about them and so on. He even decided to make tape, and he brought back the LG tape, which was supposed to be a superior, but I could never get it to work very well. Anyway, he then decided to manufacture them when he got out, and he started he converted his factory to this work and developed machines, and we were to be his West Coast representative. This is why we couldn't make a deal with Ampex right away, even though they were nice and friendly and everything. We liked the people and so on. We'd made this commitment to Ranger. This initial recording session in August of 47, when we were having our baptism of fire, Ranger came out with his equipment, which he had finished two machines and was going to turn those over to us. And this was a lot of strength, gave us a lot of strength, because these machines would prove that we could take on this job and handle it, because we were going to have American-made apparatus to back it up. And also tape. He was going to bring tape. Well, we went down and met Ranger at the railway station downtown, because he came out on the train. In those days, we all traveled on trains, pretty much. And he had the two machines, but he didn't have any tape. He had a couple of rolls of LG tape that he'd gotten from Germany. That's the first time I'd ever seen it. But he had not been able to make tape. That was too much for him to get into. That's all right. We didn't mind that. But we set the two machines up, and right away it was pretty obvious that they were not performing as well as the magnetophones. And when Murdo heard them, he was a little squeamish about that, so we couldn't push the fact that these were the machines we were going to back our system up with until they were improved. Well, Ranger stayed there, and we did the show. I took it on the two magnetophones, and he took it on his two machines, and after the recording was completed, all the people came in, John Scott Trotter, who directed the music, you'll recall, and Bing, and Murdo, and Bill Morrow, the writer. All these people except Mackenzie are dead now. And some of the others, like Buddy Cole, who was a pianist, they all came in to hear this thing, and Murdo wanted to hear the magnetophone, and then okay, now let's hear a little of that. And we played a little Ranger and then back to the magnetophone. And we went to the Ranger, I think, twice and then back to the magnetophone. And that was that. He didn't want to hear any more Ranger. A colonel had done some things that he thought were very smart things, but they shouldn't have been done.
Question. You mentioned that Ranger was supposed to bring tape but didn't. Were you still working on the tape you'd liberated?
Yeah, that's what yeah. I was, yeah. This was all these 50 rolls that I brought.
For years.
Years, absolutely. I never threw that much tape away, I'll tell you that. If there was a piece of tape that long, I spliced it back in and used it again.
What did you use
for splicing tape? Oh, at first, the Germans were using a cement. They were using a liquid cement.
They overlapped?
Yeah.
I guess they were away with that.
Right. But when I first came home and set the machines up in San Francisco, I tried doing that, and I found some cement that would work. But it's obvious very quickly that if you're going to edit program material, put it together, you can't do that. This is all right if you're just splicing one musical number onto another, or an announcement at the start and then followed by music or something where you've got gap or space to work with, it's okay. But not when you're doing tight editing. So the first thing we did was get out the old Scotch tape and try using that. That worked fine, except for one thing. When you rolled it up and let it sit for 2 or 3 days and then started to play it, they'd stick to the back because the stuff bleeds out. So then I devised an answer to that one, and that was to rub them with talcum powder at each splice. To dry up the sticky stuff, and that had to be done before you used it. It was a very awkward thing, but before you were going to play a roll that had been edited, you'd have to go through the splices and rub talcum on them and then wind it up, and it would be all right. But it wouldn't stay. See, a few days later, it'd be back again. So fortunately, 3M came up with I had one roll of this stuff. It was about an inch wide. It was white. It wasn't what we have now, but it was about that big, a roll of it. And they gave me that when we first got acquainted. And that lasted me for all through most of the Crosby shows for a year. Yeah, for a long time. I cut off only It was about an inch wide, and I used it crosswise. See, I'd cut off a little tiny piece, about less than a quarter of an inch wide, so that the tape was a little narrower than the recording tape, and I used that for the splice. Anyway, that wiped out Ranger because he couldn't. He just did the quality just wasn't there, and it was obvious that Murdo didn't want much to do with it. He told me that. He says this guy's got to do something with these things. They're no good as they are. And I told Ranger this, and he said, well, I put a lot of money into them. I can't go any further. I've got to sell these machines. He wanted $5,000 a piece for them. And he said, I can't do any more till I get some money out of them. And I said, well, you can't get them from us, I'm afraid, because this is just not good enough. Well, Harry Bryant had come around out of curiosity to see this operation that he'd heard about. Now, Harry Bryant ran Radio Recorders, which was a big independent recording outfit here in town, you know. Well, he was very interested in this, and so he made a deal with Ranger that he would buy the machines and take them, try to put them to work, but that Ranger would have to clean them up. And that's what happened. And so that severed our relationship with Ranger. Well, as soon as it was obvious that we couldn't get anywhere with Ranger, we got on the phone with Ampex, and we said, you guys have got it if you want it. Now, I mean, this is a big thing. This is your opportunity. Get going, and we'd like to work with you. We'll tell you everything we know about it and so on. And then from then on, I used to be working on Crosby down here, and I'd get on the train at nighttime and go up to Ampex for a day maybe and see how they were doing, and, you know, just consult with them and then come back down again.
What was the date of their first production machine?
The Ampex? Mm-hmm. April. I got the first two in April 48. And right away after my two, they started delivering to ABC. Then NBC bought them. NBC equipped their down in these cubicles where they had the lathes. They found room also for their machines there. And then CBS and Mutual. Well, anyway, that started us in the broadcast business. It's tape.
You were in the big time.
Yeah, you bet.